It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Thanks for having me on. My name is Robert Ovetz, and I'm a contingent lecturer in a university in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I teach political science.
So why did you decide to write this book on this material?
You know, I love that question. It's the first time somebody's asked me that. I wrote a book that I needed to read. you know, over the years, starting way, way back with Jeremy Brucher's strike, I had been fascinated with the late 19th century and the class conflicts that had emerged around that time. But I found that it was a very unusual period, one where workers actually used direct forms of militancy and what some would call violence with no real explanation. Most of the histories or references, they were actually very frequently fragmented references to these time period, to the events of this time period, never really had much explanation for why workers would, for example, arm themselves or engage in various forms of direct action to protect themselves, and forward their interests and their demands. So I felt like it was time for, this book to be written.
Is it fair to say that you're coming from an autonomous Marxist perspective? I see the use of the word recomposition and I get excited. And also, I saw Harry Cleaver did a positive review on the book. Of course, he's the author of Reading Capital Politically, and also encourage people to check out. He's done a lot of interviews, which I think that probably if you can't digest Reading Capital Politically, which is a pretty hard book, definitely his interviews will give you a really great insight, I think, into a lot of stuff from that perspective.
I can't say enough good things about Harry. I've known him for decades. I studied with him. He was my mentor, and he still is. He's still a close friend. Harry is a huge influence on me, as well as a number of other people. But one of the things about Harry Cleaver's work is I just keep going back to it time and time again. And so certainly, I would say that I use an autonomous Marxist analysis to understand capitalism and class conflict. And the reason I keep using it is because it has such a strong explanatory power. It helps me be able to understand why things are happening in many different spheres of life and how it's connected to the realities of living in a global capitalist society.
Can we just define that term?
Yeah, absolutely. So autonomous or autonomous Marxism traces its lineage back to Marx. And it kind of emerged in the 1950s with some breakaway folks from the Trotskyist movement, C.L.R. James, Raya Dunayevskaya, and a number of others in the U.S. It also was going on simultaneously in France and Italy. And it's essentially a critique of Orthodox and Leninist and kind of left-leaning socialists who are drawing on Marx's ideas. And the fundamental center of the critique is a critique of the state as essentially in service to the capitalist economy, a critique of parties. pretending to represent workers, portraying themselves as representing workers, and of unions as essentially a mechanism of disciplinary control over workers. And it looks at how workers essentially self-organize, form new types of organization, engage in class conflict or class struggle, and that we can most importantly understand the changes in capitalism, or what we call the technical composition of capital, by understanding how workers self-organize and are engaged in conflict and resistance to work. And that's another element of autonomous Marxism, is that it's very focused on class conflict being traced back to work itself, that work is the defining characteristic of exploitation in a capitalist society, and that workers' resistance to work and refusal of work is the basis for revolutionary movements and other forms of class conflict.
The description of the book states that working class resistance drives, rather than reacts to, the reorganization of capital and state reforms. Just what do you mean by this?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely shows, you know, my autonomous Marxist perspective. And essentially, the point that I'm making is that we often get caught up with the idea that reform makes it possible for workers to organize and engage, make their demands, engage with employers, or confront the state. That it takes reform for people to organize. I'm flipping that on its head, and my argument all through the book. And it's one of the sub-themes, another reason why I wrote the book, one of the sub-themes of the book, is that every period of reform from 1877 is really predicated upon responses to class conflict, rather than the reform being the basis for workers organizing and sparking class conflict. And it's something that's very subtle, but very important. It's written all through much of the discussions and analysis on the left, even among anarchists, even among Marxists. And yet the irony of it is that those in the business sector, those who own the corporations, those who manage the state, know that this is the case, that conflict leads to reform. In order to suppress or co-opt or redirect or diffuse or dilute organized movements of workers, reforms are offered as concessions. And we can see this going back to the period right after the Civil War, where my book begins in 1877. In each period of these cycles of what I call cycles of struggle, the response that essentially broke that cycle were various kinds of reforms. My book ends right before the collapse of global capitalism in 1929 and the resulting New Deal, because most histories of the kinds of concessions and reforms that lead to class workers' mobilization and class conflict is that the New Deal reforms made it possible. But what I argue in the book is that these previous periods of cycles of struggle actually made it possible for the New Deal, not that the New Deal made class conflict possible.
I think most people listening to this would agree. However, there's this progressive notion that humanity is constantly marching towards a better tomorrow.
Yeah, it's what James Lowen calls the melodrama of history. You know, the author of the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, my history teacher told me.
Great book.
And he talks about, yeah, excellent book. And several of the lies that he really kind of dissects is that lie that history is moving progressively in a linear direction, and that we already know, when we teach history, we already know the outcome. It's a kind of melodrama. And so the way that the influence of what you call liberals on much of the left is that we have to get the reforms before we can actually fight. And it's really the other way around. The reforms themselves are an expression of that reorganization. So when workers organize, engage in class conflict, go on strike, disrupt the economy, in order to restore production, in order to get the economy going again, concessions are offered, reforms are made, changes are made in the organization of work, corporations reorganize, consolidate, integrate, take over, you know, weaker competitors, and capital itself reorganizes and comes up with a new strategy. And that takes us to the next, you call it the terrain of where class conflict happens. And so those reforms are kind of an indicator for what's going on at a deeper level in our capitalist society.
So the book starts right after the Civil War. How did the Civil War itself shape not only class struggle, but also capital?
The story about the Civil War often ends with 1865, abolition of slavery, and then a few years later, Reconstruction, and then the defeat of Reconstruction. And then that's kind of the end of what we hear about the Civil War, which was an amazing struggle in itself. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, his history, Black Reconstruction, tells us about the amazing transformation that self-organized Black workers in the South engaged in. But that story is mostly told about the reform of those Southern states as part of Reconstruction. There's a flip side to it, though, and there's two elements to the implications of this period. The defeat of Reconstruction was also a defeat simultaneously of Black-white worker cooperation and solidarity. Much of the focus of Reconstruction was on reconstructing the state and the federal government to integrate former slaves and free Blacks, as citizens into the country, to extend rights to them and for that short period of time, even the protection of law against, you know, Klan terrorism, and white racism. The problem was that white workers, for the most part, were opposed to that. And so the unions at the time, which were incredibly weak, organized workers never really tried to support Black Reconstruction. And so when the president pulls out the last troops in 1877 out of the South, and there weren't that many at that time as this deal in order to take office in this backdoor deal, what a lot of people don't realize is that the very troops that were pulled out of the South to protect Blacks from white terrorism was that those troops were then sent to several places to put down a railroad strike almost at the same exact time. A railroad strike that broke out in July of 1877. The same troops, literally. And this is a very powerful symbolic statement about the failure of white-black worker alliances. When white workers abandon Black workers, they essentially cut off their nose to spite their face. They were essentially suppressed by the very same troops that were no longer protecting Black workers in the South, if that makes sense. So the outcome of the Civil War put into place a massive restructuring of the relationship of the state to individuals to protect them. A kind of liberal social contract, but that was never extended to workers. And so when this deal was cut and the president came in office and the strike broke out, essentially the response of the state was to use the state, and this is really the first big national response, to use the state in the form of the military, and as well as volunteer kind of vigilante militias that were primarily armed elites in around the country to suppress the railroad strike of 1877.
Let's just get into it. What happened and why is it important?
Well, 1877 was really kind of the calling card of the industrial working class in the United States. Without any union, there had been an attempt to create a railroad workers union, and within weeks it was already infiltrated and suppressed. They had actually called for a general strike around the country, and after it was infiltrated, they tried to call off the strike, but they couldn't. And so workers in a little town, in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and at the same time, and another place nearby in Baltimore, actually stopped their train. The news hadn't gotten to them that the strike was called off. And so over the next about 10 days or so, the workers self-organized and essentially shut down almost the entire country. And they did this without any formal organization. They did it by using the technology of the trains itself to spread the word that a strike had started. So they would the records are kind of sparse. So we don't actually have any physical evidence that this happened. But the fact that the strike spread through so many lines, train lines, so quickly and through about two-thirds of the country tells us that the workers were communicating along the train lines and across the divisions of company and even across the different hierarchies among the railroad workers, the different job classifications and so forth. So the way I teach this to my students is I tell my students that the trains were like the IT companies today. They were the backbone of the economy. They carried people. They carried goods. But what we forget, too, is that they carried information. Because during the Civil War, Lincoln really promoted the massive expansion of the telegraph. He had one installed in the White House as in the West Wing in order to manage the Civil War. And so the trains grew dramatically. We know that history as a result of the Civil War, right? The massive subsidies and the expansion in the Transcontinental Railroad and so forth, the big land grants and the corruption. So but there were also dozens upon dozens of different train companies, and they all had their own train tracks and networks, and they almost didn't cooperate. And so it made it very easy for the workers to take advantage of that weakness. The owners of the train systems were divided. They weren't unified. And the workers became unified. And so they were able to overcome those divisions between those different companies and circulate their struggle literally along the tracks, and jump the divisions of these different companies. And so in a matter of days, they literally shut down the entire country. And the federal government and the local governments and the state governments were essentially taken by surprise. There was virtually no army that year because Congress had, and this is going to sound very familiar, Congress refused to pass a funding bill. Ironically, that would never happen, you know, today to fund the military, right? But then the Congress was torn internally, because they didn't pass the funding bill, the Army, which had been severely cut back with, you know, the end of the Civil War, those same troops I talked about earlier, called up from the South were also being sent to slaughter Native Americans, out West. The Army was a fraction of its size. And from this period of the Civil War. And so they were essentially caught with unprepared. And they had to call in troops from way out in the West to come in and help put this down. Also, at the same time, there was no National Guard yet, but there were these volunteer militias that I mentioned earlier that were really poorly organized. They were relatively well armed, but they had really kind of inadequate people serving in them because they were primarily like middle class merchants and wealthy people from local towns. And so when these militias were called up, they were often routed by organized crowds. You know, most famously in Philadelphia, where they drove out the militia that had marched in from Pittsburgh a few days after the strike had started. People were killed, but also the militia literally dropped their guns and ran out of town, and the general in charge like went into hiding and resigned his commission and just refused to serve. And the other problem, they realized that when they did call up locals to get involved in the state militias, there were many private militias too. Many people refused to show up, or they just refused to shoot their guns, or they just dropped their guns and joined the crowds, because they saw their own families, they saw their own fellow workers in the crowds, and they refused to slaughter them, essentially. So the entire repressionary apparatus just literally crumbled and collapsed, and they had to call in the U.S. Army, literally.
Were these events shaped or influenced by radical ideologies, or these were just coming organically from the workers themselves?
Yeah, and this is a great question, and this is something that also motivated me to write this book, is this idea that workers organize themselves because they have obtained some sort of class consciousness or some sort of ideology of socialism or communism or anarchism, and that motivates them to organize themselves. And, in my studies of this strike and many of the other strikes that I cover, I actually found very little evidence of that. And I think others who are writing about these strikes as well that I drew from also found very little evidence of that. But I don't think that necessarily discredits these movements as being well-planned and well-organized, self-organized in themselves. For example, in the 1877 strike, these workers were very conscious of how desperate their situation was. They were being heavily exploited. The very issue that kind of prompted this strike was an issue of massive layoffs of workers, because there was a huge depression. The economy had crashed due to various kinds of speculative investments that had crashed. So the train companies were doing your typical employer kind of maneuver. They were trying to increase productivity and reduce labor costs. So they were slashing wages and they were doubling up their workloads. They were literally cutting the crews in half. At that time, the trains were incredibly dangerous. So a lot of workers were being crushed and maimed and killed. And this was happening all around the country. And all these different companies were doing the same thing. So the workers seem to have understood their own class position and their own interests quite well, and developed their own ideology, if you will, that the way that they could assert their power was to disrupt the very work that they were doing and the companies that relied on them. So what I try to do is, rather than look for what people say, I try to look for how people act and then draw lessons about how they understood their own class position from that. And I think it's also important to recognize that they didn't immediately, all through this strike also, there were, not just the workers, but also the crowds engaged in various forms of self-defense. And so, these workers didn't immediately, go home and pick up a rifle or engage in any sort of armed resistance. Their first attempt was to approach the companies and say, look, this is terrible what you're doing. And we're asking that you restore previous working conditions or stop laying us off and cutting our wages. And they were ignored. And when they tried to form a union, the union was suppressed. It was infiltrated and crushed. They had to, what I talk about in the book, they had to draw from the repertoire of tactics. They found that blocked from using, peaceful means, if you will, ordinary means of, attempting to negotiate and bring their grievances forward, they had to escalate their tactics. And so they escalated their tactics into a strike and so forth.
Find a vein and drain the black gold, hoping to God that the timbers hold. Like my father before me, it's all I know. We live only to harvest the coal, to harvest the coal. Mine owner's mercy, about as shallow as a grave. Living in shanty towns, we ain't got no say. 14-hour shifts in such a meager wage, and Mother Jones can't help us now anyway. Anyway, we'll take the roads, we'll take the train by force. Us, Lord, from the gatherings. bandanas that tell us what side you're on. Yeah, we're the rednecks of the Union 1921. We leave tonight 13,000 strong and take the fight to Blair Mountain before the dawn. Take the train by force, oh, deliver us, Lord, from the gathering storm. Lay down your Bibles, take up your guns, Blair Mountain, here we come, here we come. Still buried in the mine, I fight for my son so he'll have a better life. We're soldiers of the Great War, and it don't seem right to treat a man like a dog just to make a dime, just to make a dime. We'll take the roads, we'll take the trains by force, so deliver us, Lord, from the gathering storm. Lay down your Bibles, take up your guns, Blair Mountain, here we come, here we come, here we
Timbers. Remember when I was reading about the Great Upheaval, one of the things that struck me was that at a certain point, black workers and white workers were working together on different demands and stuff like that. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, so there's some evidence of that, and I think the strongest evidence of it is in St. Louis, because this 1877 strike really ends while it's being repressed and in various locations, workers are being forced back onto the trains and to operate the trains. In St. Louis and East St. Louis, something extraordinary happens. And that is that, black and white workers, march through both towns. They're over across the river from each other, and they call out workers out of different workplaces and, through, multiple marches each day. A committee kind of self-appoints itself and, it becomes the city coordinating committee. They set about to try to take over and run the city. There's a kind of tragic ending to, that general strike, particularly in St. Louis, which has a lot to do with race. But for a few days, black and white workers essentially run St. Louis and East St. Louis.
So you talk about working class recomposition in the Great Upheaval. I'm just curious because you use this term several times. What do you mean by that, recomposition, and how does this play out?
So this book is written as sometimes referred to as a workers' inquiry from above, and it's retroactive. So what I'm trying to do is go back to this, what I think is a monumental period in American history, and look at why class struggle and class conflict have gotten so intense. Why did workers end up eventually arming themselves in numerous instances, even more than it's covered in the book, defend themselves and, push forward their demands and interests. And what I found was that in the process of, engaging in these strikes, The workers had found ways to organize themselves across various barriers and divisions, including race and job classification, geography, companies, even industries. By doing so, they engaged in what we refer to as the recomposition of the working class's power. You know, earlier I was talking about how, you know, reform is often followed by a kind of reorganization of capital, and a new strategy emerges to manage the economy. So when that happens, the working class gets, fragmented. It's defeated. And that's what we refer to as the decomposition of working class power. So, capital finds a way to divide workers from each other so that they can restore production and reproduction and get the economy moving again, get capitalism moving again. Then it's up to workers to figure out how they've been defeated, study that new organization of capital, and figure out ways to organize themselves to shift the balance of power back in their favor. And that, when they do that, we refer to it as the recomposition of working class power. And if you're interested in this, I encourage you to look at a new magazine called Notes from Below. It comes out of England, and I've written for that. But that's, they use the workers' inquiry to understand what we refer to as the class composition.
We're speaking with Robert Ovetz, author of When Workers Shot Back. So after the Great Upheaval, you then talk about more railroad strikes that broke out in the 1890s. So what happened in this period, and how did the experiences of the Great Upheaval then influence what happened decades afterward?
This is one of my favorite parts of this history. You know, in response to the 1877 railroad strike, the working class is decomposed. These train companies start to merge and take over each other and become consolidated until there's really only a few large mega train companies. But they start doing some other things as well. They start to integrate also with the financial sector. Banks start buying up the railroads. They integrate with the coal mining companies because these trains run off of coal, and the telegraph companies and so forth. And so capital reorganizes itself. It consolidates across different industrial sectors, and that's how it's able to defeat the working class. Whereas the working class was able to use capital's division against itself, capital's now consolidating and reorganizing itself. And so by the time we get to the 1880s, we really only have a few really huge integrated corporations now that are not just train companies. They're actually these, what we today would call, you know, multinational corporations, although they're primarily in the U.S. So in the 1880s, there's this call in 1886, a call for a general strike. It mostly happens around Chicago, right? The famous Haymarket Square martyrs, slaughter happens then. Over the next few years, a new kind of union emerges, called the Knights of Labor. And it was a kind of secret oath-bound group that believed that all workers should be in a single union. It kind of was a precursor to the IWW, the Wobblies. They also include black workers. There's some women who are in this union as well. They're very decentralized, and they start carrying out various strikes around the country and in the railroad sector. They have several big successful strikes in the early early 1890s. The Knights of Labor come together with some militants in various train brotherhoods. These are craft unions that don't cooperate with each other. They don't bring in, you know, workers in different, you know, even on the same train line if they don't have the same skill. So many people are leaving those brotherhoods, and they, with the Knights of Labor, in 1895, they form an entirely new union that comes out of Chicago. And this is headed up by Eugene Debs, called the American Railway Union, sorry, the ARU. The ARU almost immediately wins this massive strike. So they really became incredibly popular. They allowed every railroad worker to join. Initially, the there was a struggle over whether or not black workers could join. And at their founding convention, they sadly, tragically, somebody includes a clause that limits the union only to white workers, and that'll play a role a little bit later, which I'll explain. But they kind of shoot themselves in the foot from the get-go. But there is a very impressive aspect to this union is that it accepts all workers in the industry, regardless of what their wage or their job responsibility is, and even whether or not they actually currently have a job if they were laid off. And so on the heels of winning a big strike, workers just start banditing the brotherhoods, or unorganized workers just sign up, and they form hundreds of lodges around the country. There's this brutal strike that happens in this company town called Pullman, near Chicago in Illinois. And Pullman is run by this guy, George Pullman, who treats his workers essentially like slaves. And so after several attempts to organize, they finally carry out a strike, and they call on the ARU to boycott all Pullman cars. And just a little side note here, Pullmans were like a Lamborghini of train cars. You know, you spent a lot of money to ride in a Pullman car because it had, you know, a waiter. It had mostly an African-American kind of at your, you know, your beck and call, is almost like your paid slave. It was a luxurious car. They were, you know, handcrafted and very comfortable. So the ARU members essentially forced Debs, who didn't want to call a strike, to boycott, force the ARU and force Debs to support it, for the ARU members to refuse to handle any train that's carrying a Pullman car. And that's virtually every train. So within days, the ARU workers, shut down virtually the entire country. It's like 1877 all over again.
So before we talk about the Seattle General Strike, was there previous examples of the General Strike being used? I mean, would we consider, the Great Upheaval an example of a General Strike? Were General Strikes called often before that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, what is sometimes referred to as Great Upheaval or an 1877 railroad strike could be called a general strike because it happened universally throughout the entire sector of the railroad industry. A general strike can also be in multiple sectors of the economy in a specific geographical area, like a city or an entire country. When it becomes universalized throughout society, and it's not just workers in one sector, that in people throughout the community, say refuse to go to work and come out and support, people who are actually striking from their paid work, that can be called a general strike. The 1877 strike, the 1894, ARU, railroad strike, I refer to those as general strikes, and I think it's commonly accepted that they're general strikes because they shut down an entire sector. Before Seattle, there were about a handful of general strikes as well in various cities, around the country. We refer to them loosely as general strikes. I would say that they were, you know, in one city, it's where the streetcar workers all went on strike and essentially shut down the entire city. But it doesn't appear that other workers and other sectors, supported them. So it's kind of a loose term that's used whenever like a geographical area gets shut down. Or meets one of those three kinds of definitions.
Well, let's talk about the Seattle General Strike. I mean, this is just an amazing example in U.S. history where there was a strike in a large city and essentially the workers took over for about a month, I understand.
No, it was less than 2 weeks. The Seattle General Strike has to be understood in the context of what was going on during World War I, which is another chapter of my book. There were widespread wildcat strikes all through World War I, and this is a little known history of what was going on with class conflict. But as soon as World War One ends, after the U.S. has only been involved for a year and a half, many workers are laid off. Wages are slashed, unemployment skyrockets, and a strike movement essentially emerges. In Seattle, as a result of this period, from around 1914, 1915, much of the city was well organized. They had dozens of pretty influential and powerful unions. Many of the unions cooperated through their labor council. The Wobblies were very strong, and particularly the port workers, the longshoremen, the sailors' unions were incredibly strong. And as part of one of the kind of continuing legacies of the period of World War One, the Marine Workers Union, which had I think over 50,000 members in just Seattle, had an ongoing grievance with one of the I call it the labor planning state agencies that was still around from World War One, and they went out on strike. And they immediately went to the labor council and said, you know, we are asking for, solidarity actions. And just to show you a little quirk about how sometimes these amazing events happen when the leadership's not around. The leaders of the council had been in San Francisco on a trip to support Tom Mooney, which is a whole nother story. Mooney had been set up and served several decades in prison for, he was charged with setting off a bomb during World War One Preparedness Day event. When the leadership was out of town, all the other delegates voted to call a citywide general strike. and so the strike began. And they almost immediately didn't just do what happened in 1877 and 1894, they literally took over and ran the city, although that was tried in St. Louis, as I mentioned earlier, in 1877. And by running the city, what they did was they created a kind of safety patrol. So the vets got together set up a patrol to make sure that, no one tried to attack the city, none of the elites or the police, the state police, the National Guard, who had been driven out of the city, that they weren't able to come back in and, carry out sniper attacks or something. They published their own newspaper, daily newspaper, to inform the city what was going on. And this is not, a lot of it was coordinated through the strike committee of the Labor Council. They kept the hospitals open. They made sure that, milk was still being produced and the laundries were still operating. The workers all around the city set up their own communal kitchens, served tens of thousands of people, several times a day. They essentially became, the strike committee became the, you could say the coordinating committee of the city. Business owners, wanted to try to reopen their business, they had to go to the strike committee and ask for permission. And the only things that they would allow to open were the things that I just mentioned. So for several days, they ran the city. And the city council had fled and the mayor had fled. But while they were out of town, they were busy, organizing a repressive force. They drafted University of Washington students and armed them. They created a vigilante force, and they placed them all around the city in armored vehicles mounted with machine guns. They were mounting an invasion of the city, which would have been a brutal, bloody mess. And so the winds of repression had started to kind of filter through the city, and I should also add, the American Federation of Labor also got involved and threatened any AFL affiliated union that was out on this strike to go back to work immediately, or they would be kicked out of the AFL and they would lose their union. So one by one, some of those AFL unions started to tell their members to go back to work. And then after approximately 10 days, the strike committee announced that they would end the strike the next day.
And this is 2 years after the revolution in Russia, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is a period of not just the recomposition of the working class in the U.S., but globally. There wasn't just a revolution in Russia, which had been going on for a while before the Bolsheviks essentially, you know, seized power and, you know, took over. But it was also going on in Hungary, of course, the Mexican Revolution, and in Germany, in the Netherlands, workers' councils. You know, this was a period of global working class conflict. And there was a lot of fear that, you know, the workers taking over Seattle. They didn't have a political party. They didn't have a single union. They didn't have an overt class consciousness. There was no charismatic leader, that this could spread. And in fact, the reason why, you know, they essentially called off the general strike was because they were isolated. You know, very little had spread outside of Seattle. So, you know, they could have, you know, could have been a lot of destruction and loss of life, once the repressive forces arrived. But, you know, during that time, they demonstrated for a short period of time that it is possible for workers to self-organize and take over and run society and to do it in a way that serves the immediate needs of the population. And, you know, should also add that, you know, later in the year in Ottawa, for I believe 5-6 weeks, a similar kind of general strike took over that city, and the workers pretty much ran it too as well.
So you end the book by talking about the Redneck War, the Battle of Blair Mountain, all these running battles, these violent class conflicts and insurrection in the coal fields. Let's get into that.
Yeah. So again, you know, what was going on after the end of World War One continues. What was going on during World War One continues and really escalates in the coal mines. In several states, and you know, the events you just described, we tend to associate with West Virginia, but it was also happening in Ohio and Pennsylvania and so forth. But in the winter of 1919, there are several general strikes in 1919 besides Seattle. There's a steel strike that's defeated, but in the winter of 1919, there's a general strike across several states in the coal mines, The mine workers union, unfortunately, put most of its emphasis, in, states other than West Virginia. There's essentially two main kinds of coal, and they tended to focus on, the miners in the larger, coal, production areas, outside of West Virginia. And so, this strike essentially was, led to a standstill, but not in West Virginia. Where the miners union had pretty much ignored those miners. They were quite disgruntled. And over the period of about a year and a half, 2 years, there were various conflicts all through West Virginia. There were various shootouts. There were, mass firings. There were various forms of repression. You know, John Sayles, famous film, Mott 1 is about, a particular incident, that happens in, West Virginia, and tells a small part of the story. And eventually, the workers kind of, are fed up, with the fact that, you know, except for their state union, you know, the national union is not coming to their defense, because they cut this deal with the mining industry, to settle, the winter strike. And so they start to self-organize in many different mines, and it's, you know, it's debatable whether or not the state union leaders are secretly helping facilitate what becomes not just a general strike, but it actually an armed rebellion where the miners form into what you call the Redneck Army. It's sometimes referred to as the Miners' Army, and engage in days of pitched battles. With vigilantes and state militia and even the U.S. Army. But the union in West Virginia was very instrumental in organizing essentially what is an armed workers' rebellion. One of the extraordinary things about this, like many of the other periods that I cover in the book, is the way new kinds of technologies are developed and in the class struggle, and used as a weapon. You know, I talked about the telegraph when after 1877, the telephone came into use, the police paddy wagon came into use as new tools in the class conflict. During the Miners' War, as you mentioned, the airplane was used by this kind of legendary cowboy army captain, Colonel Billy Mitchell, who's credited with forming America's first Air Force. He puts together a small crew of people, and they fly these very fragile airplanes from D.C. into West Virginia with the intention of bombing the miners' army. There were several skirmishes, settlements. The workers started to retreat. Then they reformed and went back. And finally on Blair Mountain, the final big battle happens. And Billy Mitchell arrives. Some of his planes kind of crash and blow up, catch fire. It's kind of a comedy of errors, but eventually some of his planes arrive. And it's debated whether or not Mitchell actually dropped missiles. I couldn't say they were bombs, but they were kind of like, you know, because airplanes had only been used by Italy and Ethiopia prior to this period and, you know, prior to World War One. So planes were still kind of an early stage of development for warfare. But this is the first time in the United States that airplanes were used to drop bombs on people. And it's kind of a precursor to what happens in Philadelphia with Moon, of course, in the 80s.
Ain't fucking with us, yo. Welfare, got no respect for my moms. I found out George Bush was the same as Saddam. I'm a digital bomb, downloaded on a CD-ROM. Before Muhammad and the Holy Quran and Egyptian gods, Abraham taught the science of prom. Breath of life, education of Christ, gave Satan his life. He bought souls when they came with a price. I got the dice, rolling 3 sixes, blowing widow kisses. Keep wizards reading Hebrew scriptures. Each gun go a longer distance to get ya. I developed so the seller get the bigger picture. Ron O'Neill, Superfly without no deal. I'm Shaquille when it comes down to lyrical skills. Maccabee, BSC to Israel. What I can't eat in the mill, I guess I'ma leave in my will. Set fire to America's flag in the president mask. I raise the stakes like the price of gas. We tryna save up for AKs. Have a helicopter, niggas screaming Mayday. This is black market military, don't play. Ain't no coming at my family the wrong way. Ayy, we tryna save up for AKs. Have a helicopter, niggas screaming Mayday. This is black market military, don't play. Ain't no coming at my family the wrong way. Hey, child support, disrespecting my pops. It's fucked up when your man breaking bread with the cops. They love talking a lot, so we send their heads back in the box. This for Ray Charles and Red Fox, let them for shot. And all the brothers in the prison cells living in hell. It's dawn of the dead, we born here to war with the feds. Lead a snake to the edge, watch them fall off the ledge. It ain't over till we kill them and all of their eggs. Try to kick down the White House door, cause they wipe out poor people that's homeless. Who life might cost, while the rich get rich. The poor get poor, so we run a menage on both Bush's daughters. Yeah, to show them all the riches that his twin sisters bought us. That made a world trade when they slept with a slave. The same ones that got AIDS, the sickness y'all made. The resurrected Nat turned his back from the grave.
When I write, the angels cry. Tears fall out of the sky. Hit the earth, take human form and fly. Prophets and messengers rise out of their graves. My enemies retreat, four-legged beasts back to the caves. Mountains of caucus, I'm just dealing with higher forces. Satellites take flight while I'm swerving, bulletproof bosses. The first dynasty was that of Egyptians before commandments. My name was written in gold inscriptions. When I spit, it's like bearing witness to Allah. Take a shahada, Nat Turner burn a soul of a rider. It's like me and you subtracted from two. Last one left, right over left. A coward dies, thousands of deaths. Let the revolution start, where's your heart? Let your heat pop. Feel the lost cause of a fiend when she lost pop. Betty Sebastian slugs told Malcolm Chesney drop. Autobahn building, might get murdered what I'm revealing. Cinematic like Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 9-11. Mac 11 flaming the president's head till it's 7.
I think going over this history, a lot of people will be struck by how much things have changed. How did we go over from seemingly wide acceptance of, you know, insurrectionary activity to advance working class goals and demands and better conditions and achieve a different kind of way of life to what we have today?
It's not a linear direction. Even during these different periods of intense class conflict, and some of them where these workers, you know, took out their weapons. Many of them already had weapons at home. They did it not as their starting point, but they did it really kind of late in the development of their struggle. As I mentioned with 1877 and with some of these other examples, they started with ordinary, legal, constitutionally protected means of collective action. They petitioned their employer, they marched, they protested, they formed unions, they tried to engage in collective what today we call collective bargaining. Sometimes they even had a contract. They went to the state, local government officials with their complaints. And time again, the law and the balance of power was against them. They were ignored, they were repressed, they were co-opted. They were fired, they were beaten, they were killed, and they used different tactics. And what I argue in the book, and I make what I call a theory that I call the trajectory theory. With each attempt to co-opt or repress them, they escalated slowly the intensity of their tactics. They drew from a range of different tactics until, you know, eventually in most of these instances I cover in the book, they eventually engage in armed conflict. But it's not offensive conflict. They don't start with it. But because the law is tilted against them, they find that, they have to escalate their tactics, and sometimes they engaged in armed self-defense. And it's not unique just to the United States. We can find this in many other countries around the world, even today with what's going on. When people feel that they're locked out of the political system, when they're not being heard, they will find tactics that they can use to defend themselves. But I wouldn't say that, their use of self-defense even at that time was widespread or even popular. They tried many other different kinds of tactics and strategies before they ended up resorting to this. And in many cases, that actually led to their own repression. And there was a lot of loss of life, a lot of destruction, when the military was called out, and against crowds, for example. So I think that it's not a simple, you know, 1-0 relationship between, you know, the situation that you face and then the kinds of tactics that you decide to use. In each of these cases, these workers had to understand the situation they were in, and figure out what kinds of tactics might work and what's the strategy.
For sure. But I mean, I would say that the way that we're brought up in society is sort of like, it's like Jesus kind of died for our sins, that, you know, that there was violence back then. But then the New Deal happened, you know, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, we can use the existing institutions to make change. There's no reason to engage in the kinds of class conflict that happened in the past. That was back then. This is now.
The way I look at it is that, and this is part of the reason why I wrote this book about that period, was that all the other existing forms of organization could no longer meet the needs for the deep fundamental change that was needed. And so these workers innovated new forms of organization. They engaged in new tactics and new strategies, and brought about some deep, long-lasting changes in our society. And I think we're at that crossroads right now where many of the existing forms of organization, from unions to NGOs, to various kinds of activist groups, just no longer are that effective anymore. They've either been co-opted or they're able to be absorbed, or their demands are too limited, or they're not able to clearly identify the situation that they face and find the appropriate tactics and strategies to confront it. And we're suffering for the consequences of that, right? Climate catastrophe, the mass incarceration of immigrants and refugees, you know, you name it, the list is long. And so I think we can learn from this period, 1877 to 1921, and see how we really need to move outside of pre-existing organizations and find new ways to confront the problems.
Yeah, one of the things I always think about is the during the West Virginia teacher strike, the red bandana became such a symbol because people associated it with the redneck war. And there was even a period in which I think the governor said something like, oh, I was afraid they were going to shoot me, those hillbillies, or something like that. And people really like took it as like, well, yeah, you know, they took it as like a positive statement that like the governor was scared. And it's just interesting how there's still a connection to this history. It's kind of like buried deep down, but people can find it sometimes and it, you know, comes out of us. What can this history inform us today in the struggles to come and the struggles that are here right now?
Well, I think your analogy to the red bandana is an excellent answer to your question. You know, and this is not just in West Virginia. It even happened, the teachers chose red in Arizona of all places and in Oklahoma. And they've essentially learned their lessons about what happens when our existing unions just don't cut it anymore. They're not willing to or capable of fighting because they're tied in to the existing structures of power, and they become disciplinary mechanisms rather than organizations to struggle for the interests and demands of the workers they claim to represent. And so I think that these teachers across, my count is now 9 states, including Puerto Rico, essentially have bypassed all forms of organized labor law and labor relations, and self-organized and engaged in wildcat strikes. And they've been able to move the power structure in places that we essentially gave up on decades ago, and do so very quickly. And I think that that's the lesson, that these workers studied their own situation, figured out what kinds of tactics and strategies and organization that they needed, and did it. And I think that's the greatest lesson of all, that these workers have done it on their own.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Anything else you want to say? Is there a main website, or do you have any social media that you want people to follow to stay up with your work?
Yeah, absolutely. The book is coming out on paper on Haymarket on September 3rd, and it's called When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. And Haymarket will have it at a reasonable price, much more reasonable than the first hardback edition. And I also use Twitter, and I have a webpage where you can download and read all my writings for free. You just search for my name, OVETZ.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.